All right, welcome everyone to our session of the Football Scholars Forum. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all here today. It's been an exciting last 72 hours for football, but thankfully we are not talking about the Super League. Instead, we are welcoming David Truie, a sociologist from James Madison University and the author, of course, of Football in the Park, Immigrants, Soccer, and the Creation of Social Ties. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to David, who's going to do something new that we haven't done, as far as I remember, in Football Scars form before. And that is, he's going to take over and show images and do other fun stuff. So over to you, David. And then if you could all line up in the Q&A queue in the chat or raise your virtual hand, I can then start to line the questions up for the first round after David's comments. So again, welcome, David, and over to you.
Well, thank you so much, Peter, for this invitation and gracious introduction, and everybody else on the Zoom chat. I really look forward to speaking with you all about my book, and I wish I'd known about this group of, you know, as I was researching and writing this book, but I certainly look forward to participating in future events. So although only one of the chapters deals directly with soccer playing, as the title suggests, soccer or football is what draws and connects the men to a park in West Los Angeles. It is a game that most of the primarily Latino immigrant men brought with them from their home countries, and that served as the basis for forming relationships and reclaiming a sense of self in their new home. And it is through soccer that other engrossing park activities unfolded, namely beer drinking, storytelling, and the occasional fight. And it is also through soccer that significant outcomes emerged, primarily the exchange of work-related resources and referrals. But playing soccer together in the park was not trouble-free or without problems. As Peter wrote in his email to all of us, having fun through soccer takes a good deal of work, right? Both internally and response to threats from the outside, be it unhappy neighbors, indiscriminate police officers, irritated employers, or aggrieved family members, or today, you know, a global pandemic. You know, indeed, as chapter one is all about the work the men do to set up and secure a regular pickup game that becomes so richly meaningful to the jugadores del parque, or the park players. Before turning to what I hope is an open-ended discussion about my book and your own, and again, let me reiterate, your own experiences with pickup soccer, I'd like to show a brief video of park life one of the men in the book texted me a few years after I left Los Angeles. For my book attempts to capture the camaraderie, the creativity, the coordination revealed in this video that is often missing from the more one-dimensional portraits of Latino immigrant men. And it is through these interactions that the men built friendships, gained recognition, and exchange resources. So bear with me here. Ooh, here we go. Can you all see a video? All right, here we go. This is Polo and Ivan, two principal characters in the book.
Vamos en Tokio.
So I observed a few smiles over Zoom that suggests that this video feels fun and entertaining to you. And watching it certainly transports me back to the park and similar scenes I try to capture in my book. I'd now like to share two photographs that are not in the book, one of which I only received yesterday. So my book captures a moment in time and one filtered, of course, by my own biases and experiences in the park. Furthermore, social worlds are never static, but constantly evolving. Tony, who I'm happy to see is on the call with us today, sent me this wonderful photo from his time at Mar Vista while he was a graduate student at UCLA in the 1990s, well before they installed an artificial turf field at the park. The photo captures a recognizable scene from the park, a group of men cheerfully posing on a picnic table before or after a game of soccer. And Tony, are you in this photo? Sorry, I think you're on the mute still. I think you're still muted.
Okay, all right, can you hear me now? No, yeah. I'm not, because this was okay. Before selfies.
Ah, so you took the photo.
I was the photographer.
All right, excellent. All right, so, okay. And I want to talk to you more about this photo, because I believe I know some of the men in the photo, and I heard many stories of park life from this period. But the meaning and history of this particular moment in time is unknown to me. I imagine many of you have your own photos and rich memories of playing soccer and socializing in parks as well. Indeed, that is the promise and possibility of informal play in public space. Football in the park is my attempt to capture the meaning, organization, and history of this familiar but global scene that is known by many of you, I imagine, but most people only glimpse from afar. In fact, outsiders to this game tended to perceive and represent the situation on and off the Mar Vista soccer field as unruly and dangerous. The second photo celebrates the culmination of a project that began in January 2008. In mid-January of this year, Polo texted me this photo of him holding my book with a group of guys standing in the same parking lot from Tony's iconic photo from decades before. So there's maybe four or five parking lots, but this is the exact same parking lot from Tony's photo, just from a slightly different perspective. All right. So seeing my book out in the world in Polo's hands warms my heart, for my book aimed to capture how Polo and the other jugadores del Parque imbue their lives with meaning by coming together to play soccer and socialize in a public park. For the men I describe in my book are not one-dimensional caricatures deserving sympathy or scorn, but people living full and complex lives amid challenging circumstances. Indeed, while it was neighborhood grievances that had originally drawn me to the park, it was the soccer player themselves who captured my attention and who deserved to be brought out of the shadows. So as you can imagine, having the opportunity to share this photo and talk about my book is a real honor and privilege, and I look forward to our conversation.
Great, thank you, David. It was amazing how this all developed, because I think, David, you sent me an email out of the blue in January, perhaps, and you kind of introduced yourself and said, hey, you know, I got this book out. I would love to have a session of FSF. And I said, who on earth is this chap? and we kind of hit it off, and it was available in paperback right off the bat. And that's something I'm going to ask you about with University of Chicago Press. And I thought, you know, we've covered a lot of topics in FSF, but it's been a long time since we've done kind of a grassroots text. And so I thought this would be a nice complement to what we've covered so far, not just this year, but in past years as well. And then Tony, sent that email with photographs from his time in at Mar Vista. And I thought, this is exactly the spirit of FSF. You know, it's that same kind of organic process that you also see at times when it's working well with the Jugadores del Parque. No? So we're not an academic conference. You know, we are an intellectual pickup game. And that means that things happen that are surprising, exciting, spontaneous, random, unplanned. And I think these connections are really nice. So while we wait for some of the folks to populate the Q&A, I do have a question about the publishers. And then Peter Jones and Chris Boltzmann have questions. So one of the things that I think is very challenging still today, despite the fact that football studies has become a rather mature field, is, you know, to get academic publishers in North America to turn on to this topic of study and to sell them the idea that this is a readable, marketable book that will, you know, have a market beyond sort of institutional libraries. So can you tell us a little bit about the series that you published in and your relationship with Chicago Press, and any advice you may have for prospective authors, you know, who want to publish with a prestigious academic press on a topic related to soccer? And you know, what did you do to convince them to put it out in paperback at an affordable price, which is becoming increasingly a contentious issue in the publishing world? Thank you.
Yeah, no, all important questions. And I mean, I think, like, unfortunately, you know, in a lot of publishing, it's a bit of a story of kind of nepotism, in the sense that my advisor, Jack Katz at UCLA, was the series editor of the series. So it's an ethnography series called Fieldwork Discoveries and Encounters. So it is, you know, I think it's a good book and worthy of selection. But in terms of kind of getting my foot in the door, it was very much a story of connections, which is a lot about what the book is about too. And he was kind of able to put me in touch with the then editor of sociology, who Doug Mitchell, has since passed away. And it was kind of through that that process. But I think your point about getting, especially in sociology in the US, of course, I think in places like Australia and especially England and other places, they take sports studies much more seriously than in the US. Getting them to kind of get on board with the book about sports did take some convincing. And that's why there's a lot of talk about, you know, migration and networks to kind of offset maybe some of a hardcore take on just soccer. So it's not just about soccer. Maybe that's part of my way to kind of temper maybe some of the issues with that. But to go back a little to your earlier point about me kind of reaching out, it's interesting with academic presses. My friend who published with the University of Chicago kind of joked to me, you know, get ready for the calm before the calm, in the sense that your book is published, and especially a place like University of Chicago Press, they're not really trying to sell books. You know, I've heard other university presses will do some more promotions, but Chicago is like, you know, good luck. You know, we're going to sell it to a few libraries. We'll make our money back. We're a nonprofit. And so I kind of, you know, said, all right, let me just email everybody. And thankfully you responded, and some other people have responded. But the university presses compared to the trade presses are not doing a lot of promotion for the books. And this is my first book. I was a little naive to that, and maybe in retrospect should have started much earlier, you know, 3-4 months before the book came out, to get the word out. And a final point before we turn to the questions, I mean, with Tony's, you know, email or photo, and I hope to talk more to him about his memories of Mar Vista, because there was a big kind of Cameroonian presence there as well. And I don't know if that dates back to his time. But what's also fun, and this is kind of the spontaneity of life, is that Tony's son is at my university. My mom taught at the university he's at. So it's a nice coming together. So it's, as I think Peter said in email, some nice give and go right from the get-go. So thank you.
Great, thanks. Over to Peter Jones.
Hi. I'm thinking back to my own experiences of sort of pickup soccer. First of all, when I was a kid, brought up in North Wales, there was a huge kind of clump of kids that were really marshalled by my best friend's dad, and he turned out to be the key person, because he played a bit of semi-pro soccer himself. I then, at university in Leicester in England, a group of us used to go over to the park near the university and play, but that also had a sort of a mover and a shaker. So I just wondered about the sort of the, in a sense, you know, what sparks the gathering in the first place. Is there a mover and a shaker in the equation?
Yeah, absolutely. And in this case, it's Polo who was holding the book, and especially when there's so many kind of players, and you do need that one person, as you said, to kind of to marshal it. And Polo irritated a lot of people. They called them all sorts of kind of dictator names. But at the end of the day, they recognized somebody needed to do it. And his life circumstances, he wasn't married, didn't have children. he worked mainly nights. He could be there every day. So kind of by giving authority to Polo, they kind of were able to sustain the games. And this became much more of an issue when, and this is before, after Tony was at the park, they installed this artificial turf field that just meant lots and lots of players were coming. And it was vital to have that one person kind of take charge. But Polo didn't survive. By the time, right around when I left, he kind of got kicked out. He got tired. And then two men kind of took over the games. And last time I was in the park, they were still kind of in control.
Thank you.
Relatively close, not to Mar Vista. Chris Boltzmann, are you?
Yes, I am. Hi, David. That was great. When I first moved to Los Angeles in 2015, I moved from North London, and the closest football ground I lived to was Arsenal. And my question is around national identity, because I joined a football league, Sunday league in San Fernando Valley called the Aztec Football League. Mm-hmm. And these two Mexican officials, organizers, were quite surprised to see this South African goalkeeper looking for a team. And they assigned me to a team called Arsenal as well. Yeah. And I went in there with my poor Mexican Spanish and tried to use as many Mexican Spanish words as I could. And they turned to me and they said, "We're Guatemalan." So I played for Guatemalan side for 2 years. And my question is around, when we speak of Latinos, in particularly in Los Angeles, my students speak about this all the time. They're very quick to tell me, we are not Mexican. We are El Salvadorian, or we're Honduran, or whatever. Was that an issue in any of the football teams in this league that you studied?
Oh, yeah. Tremendous kind of, you know, internal diversity in terms of the Latino population. I think I have a quote in the book where for a white guy, oh, I thought it was just a bunch of Mexicans. And they quickly kind of learn that there's tremendous diversity, even within, you know, Mexican nationals between different parts of Mexico. And what I found was sometimes it was a point of tension, sometimes conflict, but it was really what added to the fun. You know, playing with the Salvadorans versus the Hondurans, that really added to the fun for the most part. And yes, I think, you know, tremendous kind of diversity that, as you're correct to mention, is often overlooked just by assuming that it's just Mexicans. And again, one of the first questions you received was, where are you from? And it was about your national, you know, identity. And so a South African, I'm sure that shaped how they interacted with you. But what I found, rather than we often focus on, you know, tension and conflict. And yes, that was there, but it was also really a source of fun and interaction and something to play with, like other aspects of our identities. I think in one of the chapters, I refer to it as playing with difference. And in a place like such a diverse place like Los Angeles, it's kind of part of the culture of park life, especially in soccer. And but your point about, yeah, I mean, this is about pickup soccer, but there's huge league play. Peter was mentioning it, you know, where he is. And that's also a big part of soccer life, but it's a little bit different than informal play. And we can maybe talk a little bit about that later as well.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a very interesting dimension. Chris Gaffney, over to you.
Thank you. I'm trying to figure out how to formulate this question, but I guess it starts with my sense of a pickup space in my own experience as a place of refuge, where you can go and meet not your friends, but you meet people who communicate through the ball. You don't have to have the same language. In this case, they do. But the shared experience and a sense of the pickup game, Pilada, as a kind of a space apart, a place to regenerate and to make new connections. And that there's, in a place like Los Angeles, as with New York where I live, there's undoubtedly competition for that space. Mm-hmm. And so one part of that question is, how is that competition negotiated, especially with people and groups, not people, but groups of people who are otherwise marginalized from the full suite of rights in the American city. And then the follow on to that question. I know I'm maybe going too deep down a rabbit hole here, but in the Trump and even in the Obama era, George Bush too, and then Trump, with the rabid dogs of war in the form of ICE roaming around the cities of the United States, if I were an ICE agent, the first place I would go would be to a pickup game in Queens, and I would get 22 people out the door immediately. So did that change, or and it's changed over time, obviously, but how did your engagement, or did that engagement with that sense of fear, that refuge has turned into a space of vulnerability in this Trumpian environment we live in? Did your colleagues, players, collaborators feel that or express that? And again, how did they negotiate that sense of being exposed to the carceral state of the United States?
Yeah, no, really, really important. Let me start with the first. I mean, often when I spoke to the men, you know, and, you know, what do you like about the park? Why do you come to the park? They voice similar sentiments as it's a refuge. It's a timeout. It's a break from the rest of my life. And it's very much kind of how they understood it as well. And now in the book, I show how the park connected to other parts of their lives. But nonetheless, yes, it was kind of this break, this timeout, this refuge. So your comments resonate with kind of how they saw the park as well. So that being said, you know, there was, of course, some competition, whose refuge, whose timeout. And especially in chapter one, as I show, this is something that had to be negotiated daily. And fortunately, most of the men and some women recognized that they needed to defer to some degree to some kind of control and organization to have a good game. So kind of the power of a good game sometimes trumped, desires to control the game. So it's kind of, as I show, is this negotiated product of the situation. So 50 guys couldn't play on the turf field. So they figured out, all right, we'll have this winner stays model. So they worked through this. Now, of course, the neighbors also wanted to control that space, but it was to use it in a different way. And, some wanted it just for their kids, this kind of AYSO kind of version of soccer. Some wanted to turn it into a duck pond. We're really upset that there was this soccer. And again, this was part of the political process. It led to all sorts of conflicts and eventually led to a big Sotoni. I don't know if you've been back. There's a huge fence around the field. Now, of course, they found ways to get in under the fence and other ways. But nonetheless, yes, the field as a public space was very much contested. And as I write in the book, every time I left the park, you know, after the primary stage of field work, I was concerned about what I would find when I'd get back. Chris might know the Santa Monica Airport field, which is about 2 miles away. Beautiful turf field, looks very much like the Mar Vista, and it is under lock and key. Huge fences, and the only way you can play is if you have paid to play. All right, there's no pickup. Money, very different vibe. It is literally 2 miles away. All right. So very, yes, does sound like Santa Monica. Very different kind of atmosphere. And it does not to provide, I think it was Chris as well, this refuge because, you know, you have to pay to play. The final thing is, yes, many of the men, whether they were documented or not, but as working class Latino immigrant men, faced all sorts of vulnerabilities in their lives, be it with ICE or other kind of, you know, authorities. That being said, I think this is also very much a LA story that might be different from Queens and certainly where I am here in rural Virginia, in that, yes, the sanctuary city doesn't, you know, guarantee anything, but there was not this fear that ICE was going to come to the park. Now, of course, that could change. Now, there were fears that if they were driving without a license, you know, they could get caught up in the system away from the park. But the park itself, and again, that's one of the what makes us maybe unique from other places in the U.S., certainly where I am now, is that especially kind of in West LA, there was not a fear that ICE would show up. And there was also this recognition that ICE knows that a lot of us are undocumented here. You know, it's not a surprise. They would have been here. You know, there was, and again, that can change. And I really, really wrestled with this decision because I named the park. I identify the park for all sorts of different reasons that we can talk about. And I don't identify anybody who was undocumented. I actually don't talk much about it. I just say some of the men were undocumented. This shouldn't be a surprise. And I'm not going to dive into this for various reasons, in part because of their vulnerability. But I do name the park. So, and some could take issue to that, and I'm open to that kind of discussion. But yeah, again, this feeling of a sanctuary, both kind of emotionally, but also practically with ICE, is kind of an LA story that's, you know, different than Arizona, say.
Great. Thank you. Opening round two, Ted.
Hi, David. Thank you very much for a lovely book. I really appreciate it. I have to admit, I got a little nostalgic when you started the book because I have a pickup game in Pittsburgh that I entered as a graduate student. And I have gone back over the years and the population has sort of stayed the same and come through. It's a little bit different in the fact that lots of nationalities, but it's not culturally acceptable to ask where you're from. Mm. It's just sort of come and play, see how you do. You'll get on the field. If there's not enough space, if there's not enough room in the game, we split out another game because we have lots of space in the place where we play in Pittsburgh. But I want to ask you something else that you just touch on at the end of the book. That's something that's been bothering me over a number of years. I've lived the life of an itinerant academic, and it always seems strange to me when I moved to a new town and there wasn't a vibrant pickup game. And there've been a number of places where you have to go and join a league or you have to go and join a club to get a regular game. And I was kind of wondering if you could, since you've made this move from LA to rural Virginia, what actually is missing there? Because I can't be just the connections. There's something else that seems to be missing. And then another quick question, if you don't mind, is I was kind of curious what drew people to the game at Mara Vista. Was it the community of seeing like individuals who just enjoyed soccer? Or was it the quality of the game? Because one of the things that happens in the Pittsburgh game is people want to get into that game because it's the best game within 20 miles, regardless of whether it's a league or not, unless you want to go play for the River Dogs, which is something entirely different. Thank you.
No, and just to clarify, in terms of what's missing, you mean why it's hard to find pickup soccer in some space places?
Not so much as that. So, well, I mean, that's a good question too. But I was thinking more of just it always, life felt a little hollow there. Right. And it wasn't because I couldn't make social connections. There are other social connections and other ways to make it. And you seem to point that out in background or backyard gatherings in Virginia.
Yeah.
But there's something else that's not just play, because we can get the play from the leagues. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But what is it about a good quality, even standing pickup game that can't be replicated anyplace else? And it may not necessarily be soccer. I understand, you know, from basketball, that happens there too, in volleyball pickup games and the like. So
absolutely. I think this is a broader trend of the increasing, you know, privatization of public space, the formalization of sports, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a lot is missing when we take control of organizing the game out of the players and you give it to some external authority to create the schedule, to create the rules, to create kind of all sorts of things. And I think a lot of loss, and again, a lot of the point of the book, especially about organizing the game, is by doing all of this work to create a sustainable game. So in your case, all right, two games now, you know, but they have to make that decision. And in doing that, they work together. To go back to an earlier point, leaders emerge, culture emerges, but it's because they have to do the work of creating a game that won't just automatically happen. You know, then they develop ties, relationships, where you don't get that. So I'm in a league here. You don't get that when it's say, okay, show up at 12:30. You're the home team. You're the away team. game's over, then you go home. All right. Now you have to work as a team, et cetera, but all of that other work is kind of lost. And I show, and it sounds like, you know, your experiences have resonated, is it's that work that's, you know, again, you're right. It's both about playing soccer, but when you remove all of that extra work, you don't have those opportunities to form these relationships, to establish trust, to do all of this stuff that you mentioned. Now, in terms of what drew men to this game, I think it's all of the above. I mean, I think some people talk about it was like soccer heaven. But I think it's also an LA story that at the time, there were so few accessible spaces like this. So most of the turf fields were locked up. Most of the grass fields that were available, Tony might know what the Mar Vista field was like when he was playing there. It was the moon. It was dirt. It was just, and that's, LA story in terms of the grass just turning into dirt. So I think it was the quality of the field as well. But I think the big thing, and again, other pickup games have similar kind of cultures and similar appeals, but people could count on it. All right. They knew that they could show up and there'd be a game there. And especially in LA, when you drive an hour to go somewhere in traffic, when you're busy, there was this consistency to the game, in part because of Polo. All right. Polo was a pain in the, and he sometimes showed up late and he was, dictatorial, but he was there. All right. And occasionally when he didn't show up, it was chaos. So I think it was the consistency. I think it was also the tremendous diversity. So you had Kathy, this older Mormon lady who could barely play, but was always out there. And then you had you had Tony, UCLA graduate student, these really, these players, and you had this tremendous mix. But again, all of the above that made it so kind of appealing. But I think the consistency, I think, played a underrated part in motivating participation.
Thank you. Nicholas, over to you.
Thanks, Peter. Hi, David. Really enjoyed the book. I'm calling from Montreal today, and there's actually a big snowstorm this morning. So maybe climate is more on my mind. But I was wondering how the actual physical climate in LA, and obviously maybe there's the same fluctuation as other cities, but I've been in LA where it's like brutally, brutally hot. Yeah, I'm sure anyone been there knows that. I was wondering whether there's any fluctuation throughout the year based on different, climatic changes across the year. And also I was curious about whether there are other kinds of associations which offer similar kind of forms of social connection. I was really interested in this idea that like it's a soccer is kind of like a bridging agent. It connects, the pre-migration life and the life in LA. And I was curious whether any other kind of institutions. I'm interested in sports and Christianity. So I was wondering whether Christianity or churches come in and offer these same kind of things for the players, or whether they're interested or whether that's a part of their life, both in terms of, historical links to Catholicism, but also increasing popularity and presence of Pentecostal, charismatic, evangelical Latino churches in LA, which are, seen kind of everywhere and are increasing based on my understanding of it. So thanks.
Yeah, no, great questions. And I think I should have, to go back to Ted, what about this game? It's also the climate, Southern California, it's pretty much the same temperature year round, you're playing year round, which is very different from Montreal or Peters in Michigan, things, you're not playing outside year round. So I think that's a huge story. And especially, and Tony maybe can talk about this too, is West LA, they're on they're west of the 405. So you have the breeze. So I think, Nick was saying about San Fernando, I mean, that's brutally hot, really West LA, the climate, it does get a little boring to be honest, but the climate is really perfect for year-round soccer. And the men spoke a lot about that because many traveled, especially the gentrification was pushing them out. There were, I forget all the names of the towns, but they, it was too hot there. They much preferred to to play in West LA. So the climate, yes, was a draw. And the second, yeah, I mean, there are other associations that, you know, help to build connections. And before you mention your interest in the church, the first thing that popped in my mind, of course, was church and religious life plays a huge role. Now, what's interesting is church, especially because of the Sunday leagues, was often in opposition. And sometimes they had to make choices between the two. Sometimes people, if people were complaining, they'd say, go to church. Or when I would talk to their friends and family members and say, why don't you come to the park? It's because, well, I'm, you know, I'm Christian. Church is really important to me. And there was this kind of tension, in part because of the Sunday leagues, because of, you know, just the commitment to play soccer, but also all the presumed vices that went along with soccer, the beer drinking, the occasional fights. So again, there was some kind of tension. I do think it's overstated because many of the men still were able to maintain both lives. A limitation of this book is I don't dig into their religious lives. I don't know much of what's kind of going on there, but I'm sure, and I heard some stories about church was often a meaningful place to build connections and, you know, work, other extracurricular activities, neighborhood life. You know, there's certainly, this is not the only place, but for these men, it was a particularly strong anchor in their lives, that for others, it would maybe be the church. But the relationship between the two is great. It's fascinating.
Yeah, thanks, David. Thanks, Dancer.
Great. We have a question from Enrico.
Thanks, David, for this talk. I'm calling in from Belgium. You've written a wonderful book. I really love the idea of POGs as a social infrastructure. I'm researching Ecuadorian football from a subaltern perspective. So this idea of communal spaces as places for socializing is very interesting for me. And especially because I'm looking at street football, which has become quite a traditional sport in Ecuador. They're even organizing street football tournaments these days. So I was wondering, how do you see the relation between park football and street football? Are there more negative connotations to street football than to park football? And was street football being played in your research area as well?
I mean, I think it's really dependent on the context, the situation. So one understanding that I have, I don't know much about street football. There wasn't any really in the streets necessarily that I knew of, but it was spaces. So at this park, and Tony kind of remembers, Mar Vista Park is large. So you had the turf field, but sometimes that would get permitted out to, you know, increasingly lacrosse, which is an interesting story there. But people would arrive and they would want to play. And then the other side, Tony might remember, there's a bunch of baseball diamonds and they would often play over there. And there's tremendous conflict. And again, this is different than street soccer because I don't know much about that in LA, but a lot of, and I don't know what word you would use, but unsanctioned soccer. And LA is full of signs saying no soccer play. It's usually the only signs you'll see in Spanish. It's about soccer and drinking. Tremendous contention, in part because it turns into dirt, but also we don't want Latinos there who primarily play soccer. So there's a lot of attempts to restrict, or they'll put boulders, or they'll build, you know, mounds. There's a tremendous, and Chris might also in LA see all these signs of trying to get people to stop playing soccer in certain areas. One for, you know, controlling the grass, aesthetic reasons, but I think it's much more also cultural, keeping certain groups out. But in terms of, I mean, I know that some men would play kind of football cinco, like on indoor type soccer. And there was kind of a culture there. Tony probably doesn't know, but they built a hockey rink, outdoor hockey rink in Mar Vista, and then they would play soccer there. And it's got much more of that street ball feel that you're talking about. But again, I don't know too much about, but I think park soccer has, you know, you have league soccer, you have pickup soccer, and they can have different meanings and the city can respond to them in different ways, especially who's playing. But yeah, this culture of street soccer in Ecuador is fascinating.
All right. I'll pass the ball over to Titi.
Hi, David, you mentioned in your introduction that you're biased when you write this book, or when you wrote this book. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about your positionality and like your background, your race, your age, and including your gender, and how that affect or influenced your interaction during your entire research process.
Yeah, so this is the kind of a big methodological question. And I think I would like to say I wasn't biased or try not to be biased, but I have certain biases as, you know, as you mentioned, as a white man. I was in my late 20s. I was a graduate student. You know, all of my positionality, as you mentioned, of course, shaped my entry into the park. It shaped my relationships. It shaped how I saw what I was seeing. All that being said, and I was always very kind of aware of it, in particular in the privileges I faced in this park, primarily in my interactions with the park neighbors, who are also mainly white, more educated. I had much different relationships with them than the primarily Latino immigrant men. Police, especially as well, they would often just ignore me. There's a group of us sitting around drinking. They would just not really see me in the sense, because they just assumed, you know, so of course, my experiences in the park were different than others. And I was always aware of that. And I used it as a way to make better sense of what was going on in the park. I could say, oh, wow, you know, I am dealt with differently than others. So I can maybe learn more about their experiences. All that being said, and I think that this goes back to maybe Ted's and other people's point, is that soccer really was a powerful, and again, not to be naive about our differences, but soccer was this powerful kind of bridge, this common denominator. And again, they're constantly making fun of me for being white and, you know, go back to UCLA and, you know, all this stuff. But soccer did kind of provide that link. And I will say that, you know, if you had done this study, it would have been a very different study. It would have been very, you know, you would have seen different things. You would have maybe been able to form relationships with the men in a way I couldn't as a woman. And again, I was open about it. I think maybe a little less in sociology, especially anthropology, we get really kind of caught up in our positionality, and it's just, you know, we are kind of who we are, and we need to be honest about it and reflexive about it. But I produced this study, and that's what I meant by biases, as kind of a white man in a particular time of my life. And I tried to learn from that.
Thank you. That's great.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Peter.
Over with Tony for the next question. Yep. Sorry.
Actually, it's more of a comment than a question, and then probably I'll raise some issues that we want to talk about. Yeah, thanks for keeping me on the list. I know I haven't been regular because of my scheduling conflicts on Wednesday at 2:00 in the Midwest. But when I got that email and I saw the cover, I quickly recognized the place. Because when we went back to Los Angeles, we usually go regularly on visit because we have friends there still. My old advisor is still there, so go to visit them with my kids. So when we went there after 2005 and went to the park, we were shocked to see the artificial turf and then the fences and everything. Like, what's happened? Why didn't they do it when we were there? So I felt a bit jealous. But then I read your book, and I realized that it wasn't easy even to have that artificial turf, because I thought somebody just decided to do it, not knowing there was a whole battle about it, which is very interesting. Because when we played there, it was the dirt and the baseball ring, nothing. And sometimes it rained and we played in the mud and everything. So I really enjoyed reading the book, and I have to send it to some of my teammates, especially the UCLA graduates. It was an international team, not really a team per se, because we didn't have jerseys or anything. It was a pickup game, as you have described when we were playing there in the 90s. And also, one thing is that UCLA housing was very close to the park. Mm-hmm. So we just have to walk there. So it had a lot of international graduate students. I sent you another photo, which, I mean, you didn't show, but one guy there was from Ghana in linguistics. another from Mali, the next one African American. And we had Argentines, we have Italians, a lot more from South Latin America or South America. So it was multinational. And we played only on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
Because Saturday mornings, we go there around 8. But the beautiful thing about playing on Saturday is that if you are not able to wake up early, there's always a team on that field. You join play till you're tired, and then you left.
Mm-hmm.
But we had our UCLA core groups. And knowing LA, some of you know LA, there were people coming from the Valley. There were people coming from Santa Monica, East LA, and of course, majority from West LA. So, I mean, it was very cosmopolitan, but a place where you could just come and play free soccer anytime throughout the day on Saturday was one big thing. Of course, there's a socializing aspect that the UCLA graduates had. Every day after the game, we visited somebody's house where you could have barbecue, meals, and drink a lot of beer. And then later on in the evening, you could go to a nightclub. So it was a whole Saturday affair, and nobody cared about La Migra or anything. In fact, I picked my first Spanish words from this park, from the Latino guys. And they cursed so much. So when I was reading your book, I was laughing all the time because like the same words they use, they curse each other and then they scream. But what was different from the other international groups from UCLA graduates, especially and other Africans coming from East LA, the Valley and other places was that we didn't drink at the park. We went somewhere else to drink because we didn't want to have any problem with the police at all. But our friends from South America, they drink right there on the spots after the game each time. They brought in the beer and then they drank there. So, I mean, these were some of the nuances, but most of what you have said in the book was correct. But what really shocked me was the reaction of the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have that when we were playing there at all. And it was a friendly game. And so there was no competition really. You didn't have to all have the same color. We sort of knew each other. You came in and joined the game based on the number of people on the field. So if there was 5-5, we could play 6-5. Until somebody else comes to join, and we have 6-6.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of knew each other, so we didn't have to like compete that hard. It was fun. And I mean, that's how much I remember the book. But about the games, but I really, really enjoy your book. And probably some of you have some questions that relate to both time periods, but I was glad you brought it up. I mean, you wrote this book about that experience. It was very, very helpful.
Yeah, no, that's all wonderful. It's so exciting to hear, you know, this, in a sense, it was like my first fan email, you know, that I received from you, which was really cool. And to know these shared, and just, I'll respond really quickly, because I see there's some questions. What's interesting, this goes back to Peter's initial question about like publishing. So all the photos I took that are in the book, and I had some I thought were nice pictures of the park, but this is actually MacArthur Park on the cover. It's not Mar Vista. And there's a whole like to have for cover photos, they have to have certain copyright issues. And this was, it was this weird process. I wasn't happy about it. I think it looks okay, but I know the guys are like, what park is this? Who are these guys? Because it's just some journalist took this photo and the press had to pay money to get it. So that's a interesting process. You know, what's interesting, and Tony and others, the men, and there's been some dissertations I read about great soccer games going back to the 1970s at Mar Vista. Apparently Maradona stopped there in 1990. You know, there's all these stories of this rich history at this park. And that's important because for a lot of the neighbors, they act as if soccer arrived with the new field. That they kind of didn't see, in a sense, the soccer before the new field. And again, I think it's one, maybe they didn't see it because it was dirt and they didn't really pay attention. They didn't really like it or you know, they just didn't see it. Or the field was this kind of opportunity to try to wrestle control of the park. So they saw the soccer, but it was more difficult to kind of restrict this kind of dirt field But once you had this fancy turf field, there was this opportunity to kind of control it in a way by creating a fence. And in a ways, it was kind of used as a proxy for a general concern about the amount of Latino immigrant men that were at the park. Because a lot of the concerns that they voiced about noise, parking, trash, it was about the park in general. But all of it got lumped onto the soccer field in a way that kind of implied that people just started playing soccer when the field showed up. Well, we have a living, breathing person right here that's like, no, I played there. And it was meaningful. And finally, you know, the point that Tony makes about he didn't want to risk drinking and partying at the park. So he went to his, you know, and I know that UCLA housing down the road. Most of these men didn't have that same opportunity to go back home, you know, because it was cramped, because there was a lot of people. They didn't want to create problems at home. So they didn't necessarily have the same opportunities. And they also enjoy drink. So it's not also, you know, they like drinking in the park too, but they also face certain kind of disadvantages that kept them from drinking elsewhere, like Tony was able to do, and then going to the clubs afterwards in his younger days. That's great. Great memories.
Thank you. We have a couple of folks who've joined us, and they do not have the benefit of knowing what we've chatted about already. Andrew Guest, would you like to ask a question, perhaps?
I'd be happy to give it a try. I'm worried about repeating.
Oh, we'll let you know.
I'm sorry, and I'm embarrassed that I was all excited at noon here in West Coast, and then I realized I didn't have the Zoom link, so I've been sitting here mad at myself for 45 minutes, so I apologize.
But, sorry about that.
But I did really enjoy the book, and I was looking forward to the discussion, and I appreciate the work. It's a really cool project, and I'm sure, again, you've covered a lot of the things that I was sort of curious about, but I don't know. I guess one question I often ask in these sessions, because some of my own work is about sort of soccer as, and sports more broadly as an avenue for social interventions. And one of the things that I thought was interesting about this was the way you sort of, you know, it's just this very organic space where these immigrant communities are able to find and build community and do the kind of social tying that you're talking about, which seems really important, although not uncomplicated. But it strikes me that, you know, some of it, it's so much of it is about just having public spaces for that, right? So there's no top-down management. It's not like there's a, sort of a program that is designing this for immigrants, but there are a lot of programs like that, right? In my world, there's a lot of programs that sort of say, hey, we're going to use soccer to create community and to build social ties and to build social capital and all these things. And so I guess I was curious, like I often think that it can be just as valuable to just create spaces, create good, safe, like healthy potential spaces, as opposed to sort of top-down managing how things operate. So I guess one of the big questions I had was how you know, if you've come across that, like these sort of intentional interventions where they're trying to use soccer or sport, you know, if there was ever people like social service folks or people who kind of came in and said, hey, look, this is a great site where we can, you know, do our work. And if that's a good idea or a bad idea, or how your work sort of informs that world.
Yeah, no, and it's good to meet you, Andrew, and I look forward to your book coming out soon. And it's interesting. Now I'm doing research on temporary guest workers that pick apples on H-2A visas here in Virginia, and they live in these remote camps, and they are just flooded with legal aid and healthcare and sociologists and religious people. And all of these groups, as you mentioned, kind of social interventions are going there, which is not kind of what I expected. I thought they'd be kind of isolated. And it's interesting, and I hadn't really thought, there wasn't a ton of outreach to, you know, you would think that groups would say, oh, wow, these men are here. There'd be a way to reach out to them. And now that I think about it, really not at all. I didn't see much of that. And I don't really know much of the history of that. Now, that being said, there's a lot of examples, the other people from LA could maybe of, you know, especially like day labor groups using soccer to create kind of community. And, you know, and I've seen examples of that, which makes me wonder why more groups weren't coming out to reach out to the men. And I'm guessing that they maybe had bad experiences trying to do that in like, leave me alone. I'm here to play soccer. This is, and I think this was an early first comment, I forget by who was like, this is a refuge. This is a timeout. This is my break. And the last thing I want to do is talk to some social service person about, you know, even if it was a benefit, I don't know. It's hard to know, but I do know in my 6 years of the park, I rarely saw any kind of outreach. If anything, it was disciplining the men, you know, trying to get them out of there. That's interesting. And to follow up a little bit, we talked about kind of earlier and the importance of the men doing this themselves, rather than being this top down, work. And as we talked about earlier, it's a way to then, you know, build relationships, establish trust, and so forth. Now, that being said, you know, Eric Kleinenberg talks to, I think somebody mentioned in Enrico, about social infrastructure, the importance of creating spaces where people can come together. And I think that's totally valid. But, you know, this can unfold in multiple different ways. You know, public space in and of itself doesn't necessarily create healthy relationships. So, I mean, I think that's what the value, and this goes back to Titi's question about, you know, positionality, you know, doing the ethnography, seeing what's going on the ground is important, because space in and of itself doesn't necessarily lead to, you know, healthy or I forget what word you use, social tying in this organic space. But the lack of interventions is interesting. I need to think more about that, because, you know, people came to sell things and occasionally, but social groups reaching out to the men there was pretty rare.
Thank you. And kind of building on that point, one of the things I really enjoyed about your book, David, is how it blurred the boundaries between work and play, which are two spheres that we often think about and evaluate, analyze separately. You've got that chapter, I think it's chapter 5, where you go and visit the workplaces of a dozen of these players. And you're also pointing out how the leisure, the sociability that's taking place at the park is really important in sustaining employment opportunities, or at least the prospect of employment opportunities. So I think that was really intriguing in the way that this public space is, you know, the area in which work and play come together, interact in very unexpected ways in some respects, if you're not paying attention to that kind of ground dynamic, that you know, action from below. I also like the way in which your book kind of, you know, not that we needed another debunking of it, but really explodes this myth that somehow you bring sport to the working class and, you know, it's got all these great moralizing influences. Quite the opposite. People are swearing at each other. They're, you know, fighting, though that is not, you know, particularly brutal in the vast majority of cases. They're drinking sometimes too much. They're smoking joints. I mean, they're doing all those things that, you know, the urban missionaries and do-gooders, you know, seem to assume that will stop happening, or, you know, a big dent will be put in these activities once, you know, that ball is dropped in the middle of the pitch. So I really like that. I also was thinking about this kind of battle over public space that emerges towards the end of the book. And I was keen on kind of learning more about it, because, and some folks who have spoken have already mentioned this, but it seems to me that this kind of subalternity that's unfolding around competitive sociability is really kind of representing the constituency that cares about public space, about the commons, whereas the neighbors in this park, the, you know, for lack of a better word, the elites, I know that's not a very sociologically precise term, but, you know, these white upper middle class folks, they don't care so much about the commons, especially if it attracts different kinds of people. They're more about privatized leisure, you know, the pay for play form of leisure. And so I was wondering what you drew, you know, what lessons you drew about this ongoing struggle in America over the commons, and sort of who's fighting for it, and for what kind of outcomes.
Yeah, no, this is great. Thank you. The first with the work and play, I mean, I think the big kind of you know, move for me to really make sense of the park. And it took about 2 years of building relationships, was to see how the park mattered in the rest of their lives. And the clearest way was to follow some of the men at work. And here I could see how kind of ties developed at the park, literally, you know, led to work referrals, work relationships, work resources. I could see that on the ground. And also at the same time, when I'm with the men at the park, I could see that they're constantly talking about the park. Let's get back to the park. Maybe we can go through lunch to get a break, to go to the park, talking about park stories. So how park life also kind of animated their work lives. And again, a lot of these, I wasn't able to really look at restaurant work, another big sector of employment, but you know, these were, you know, blue collar kind of, you know, tough jobs. And the park was a way to kind of animate it in different ways. I also saw a lot of these were independent contractors where the park provided kind of a quote unquote pit stop in a sense when they were on break from other jobs, in the same way coffee shops did that for, you know, out of work actors or what have you in LA. So it kind of was a place to spend time. So, and I think, you know, I don't know, you know, with students, I often say, yes, you know, study a certain place, but see how it fits into their lives somehow, be it work, at home, or other aspects of their lives, going back to a question about religion. So that was a kind of an important move, I think, for this book. I was also able to see, and this is kind of a central tension in this book, but also in immigrant history, is how these men were very much welcomed and depended on in private homes of, as you mentioned, kind of elites or upper class whites. They were very much welcomed to work in homes, and they developed close relationships. Yes, somewhat kind of hierarchical, but nonetheless, these close kind of relationships when they were workers. But when they became kind of, you know, this worker people tension, when they were people in the park, they were not as welcomed, in part because they were seen differently, but also because there was a sense that these men should be working. It was kind of their idleness also that was a problem, because you never heard any concerns about the Latina nannies that were in the park, because they were seen there as kind of working. But it was by following the men at work, I could really start to make sense of this different reception they received, which is a central kind of, you know, in the United States, but we have other countries as well represented here, this love-hate kind of relationship with immigrants that was really palpable at the park. Because again, I didn't follow any of the men working in Mar Vista immediately, but, you know, I would walk around, it was full of Latino immigrant men and women working in these homes that were unhappy about all the Latino immigrants that were in the park. So that kind of leads into the kind of the second, again, I'm open to discussion about broader questions about the future of the commons. But I think one of the central paradoxes of public space is it belongs to kind of everybody, but kind of nobody at the same time. And, you know, nobody can kind of control it over others, but they can all use it. And that really played itself out in this park, where the neighbors, yeah, some wanted to get rid of the park, but others, they liked the park. They just didn't want it to be used for this vibrant soccer scene. They wanted, you know, a different, more passive type of experience in the park. Again, this is a central tension playing out in LA, but, you know, in all over, over public space. And often the response is to either privatize or to really make it difficult for certain groups not to feel welcomed or to belong in public space. And that seems to be kind of the two avenues that are often taken.
Excellent. Thank you. Over to Andrew Lee.
Hey, so I turned my camera off because the internet started to behave badly. So I was taken by Peter's two comments about work and play, but also the commons. And I had a slightly interesting experience when I was the treasurer of our local soccer club, which ran a bunch of youth leagues, and that there's a park in our town. And when people would go to play soccer in the park, they would complain to the soccer association that they're actually daring to play soccer in the park. And this had, the people who lived around there didn't want people playing in the park. I don't know what they thought people were going to use the park for. I think just to look at it. but you weren't supposed to play in the park. And then we had a dedicated soccer field in town, and they closed it because they decided to turf it with artificial turf. And so for a while, a bunch of us adults that played on fields that, quote unquote, were public but belonged to the baseball association. And so after playing on that field for 3 weeks, we came to find temporary fences set up so we couldn't play anymore. And they've claimed that public park just for baseball with a fence and gates. And then the soccer field, when they finished turfing it, they fenced it and they put it on it. And there were major discussions about people playing in the park who weren't from the town, playing pickup games. And they instituted a fee that every child playing soccer had to pay $5 in the fall and $5 in the summer. And then they tried to use this to police who was playing in the fields, that if you weren't part of an organized team that had paid the fee, they could kick you off or arrest you for trespassing. So, and you know, and in large part that field, it was about Latinos from around the area coming to play soccer and pickup games and not, quote, behaving correctly. And most of these people couldn't, I mean, we had the Catholic Church across the street want us to change the schedule of games because people who need to use the toilet were going to the church to pee. And people were actually daring to park in parking lots and, you know, play pickup games. And that was opposed to. So I think what you said about the commons is right. It's only commons for the right people.
Yeah. And no, this is great. And I mean, I think my book is about one field in one particular moment in time, but it's clear that these type of conflicts are happening all over the country, big cities, small cities. So that's kind of the goal of ethnography. And Peter mentioned, you know, you'd like to learn more about the neighbor conflict. You know, originally I was going to have a chapter about it. I wrote an article in City and Community that really, it's a deep dive into the neighborhood conflict. If you're interested, the editor thought it was boring. And so it got basically dumped into the conclusion, but it's there. And I think, you know, what's also interesting, and it shows, you know, city planners don't always, they build things and don't always anticipate the consequences. So, you know, as Tony knows, there's a long history of soccer at Mar Vista, and that was part of the reasons they said they needed an artificial turf field because they couldn't grow grass. So there is this history of soccer. The local residents who had the political capital, they were able to get Proposition K funding, close to $1 million to build this field. It was all the local residents. So they're the ones that organized to build it, secured the funds, pressured their city councilmen, and with the goal of having this nice field for their kids who were gravitating to AYSO soccer. They had no understanding of the amount of interest there was going to be for this soccer field. So for them, it really did feel like a quote unquote invasion because they did not anticipate the interest because so many other fields were locked up. And so there was this interest that they completely underestimated. And so it's this kind of story of, you know, city planning and so forth, which I think is interesting. And the men themselves assumed they wouldn't be, they saw it being built and said, there's no way they're building this for us. And they were almost surprised that they had access to it. And so again, a nice kind of story of urban life. And to final on Andrew's point, I mean, I think the point of the book is, yes, we see all of these assaults on public space by all the stuff you're talking about, fees and boulders and fences and locks. And this book hopefully shows that a lot is lost when we deprive people of these spaces to do all the things that are documented in this book. You know, like what kind of life would Paulo and the others, me, the PhD student, you know, the type of things that would be lost when we don't allow these type of spaces, to go back to the earlier Andrew's point about, you know, these organic spaces and the things that are lost and We're seeing it here in Mar Vista. We're seeing it all over the country in terms of, you know, there's a great video of the quote unquote Dropbox bros in San Francisco. You might've seen it's a couple of years. They show up with their permit to kick out these kids. And again, this story is not unique in any way.
Great. The next two questions, Declan and then Nicholas again. And we have about 15 minutes or so left plus added time.
Hi, David. Thanks for being here. I actually have a similar question to Andrew's. I play a lot of pickup soccer here in Atlanta. And an issue this year, especially with COVID, has been the difficulty in sort of maintaining a singular space to be able to play. And so I know your focus has been on one park and one group of people there. But what I've found with my pickup group has actually been sort of a consistent desire to keep changing where they play. And the group stays the same. And there's people that come and go, certainly, but that it's a constant pursuit of better fields as we continue to kill grass in certain areas. So I'm wondering if you ever saw the group as willing to move, especially maybe if the new turf fields were full and things like that.
Yeah, no, great questions. Well, there's a history of this field in particular. And so there's old timers and there's older timers. And Tony might know there's a Penmar Park down the road where there's a big group. Polo and the others used to play down the road, maybe 2 miles, a similar park. They would play there and then they kind of got kicked out of there. And then they migrated over to Mar Vista, you know, in the 1990s. And they're still referred to as go back to Penmar, you know, 25 years later. So there is this kind of story of movement around. But I think one of the appeals is Mar Vista is they've been able to sustain this space here. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I always, you know, I did field work for about 5 or so years. And every year I would come back for about 6 years. And every year I came back, I was worried I would see serious lock and key on this field. And I always worried, you know, what would the men do? Off when they built the fence, it took about 6 months. They played on the other side of the park, kind of in the outfield. And it was really only the more hardcore members that played. The guys that just were connected to the soccer, they didn't come back because for them, the appeal was the nice field. It wasn't the camaraderie necessarily. So they didn't show up. They waited till the field was open again. But again, I think, yeah, they would adapt, but there is such a strong connection to this park. And again, a lot of them are getting older now. I don't know, but I'm sure, you know, young guys like you, they can't play at Mar Vista. They love soccer. They would quickly find another place to play. And the LA is full of these stories of games emerging and falling and depending on the space, the numbers, et cetera.
Thank you.
Wandering footballers.
And I hear Atlanta, the soccer scene is amazing there. Everyone says, so hopefully it is.
It's absolutely great. And we actually spent quite a lot of time outside of Mercedes-Benz Stadium, the new stadium, using their sort of tailgate area as the pickup area because it had real nice grass and it was lighted during the winter in ways that the public parks weren't. And so they sort of let the community have access to a place that usually was very restricted for people willing to pay.
Nice.
Thank you. Nicholas, and then Tony again.
Thanks, Peter. I just had I think one of the interesting things about the book to me is that when I was thinking about the book, I was thinking about William Tantum's book, Laying the Football Talk. I don't know if people read that book, but it's about pickup soccer in certain ways in Jamaica and kind of rural Jamaica. And it's a lot of same things about intergenerational kind of relationships, social capital, inequality, but it's very much... It's a different, and maybe in a sense, because there's really kind of a class, there's maybe a greater class variety amongst those games. But I guess one thing that interesting about that book is that there's a really strong focus on the role of watching the English Premier League and kind of its role in kind of forms of social capital that are built through these experiences. And one thing I enjoyed about your book, David, is that these, you know, particular moments where there's a discussion of where they would, you know, watch games in someone's house or things like that. And I was kind of wondering outside of them talking about the soccer at the field, I was wondering whether there was like a constant discussion about world soccer in the same way, and whether they gravitated towards certain leagues or of certain teams, whether it was kind of, you know, whether it was rivalries that go back to kind of where these guys grew up or things like that, or whether it was more global, whether they, you know, talked mostly about the Premier League, or whether it was, you know, Mexican leagues or El Salvadorian or things like that.
No, that's great. And I think this goes back to Peter's initial email, is about that the game in and of itself. Yeah, it was fun, but it was the layering of all the other, you know, biographies and stories and dramas that really made it fun, you know, and, you know, people's histories, people's jokes, how people looked, their nationality was all part of the fun. And another big part of the fun was connecting the pickup games to pro world soccer. So there was this intimate kind of connection. So constant jokes about, you know, a player falls, you know, you play like the you know, Messi and I'm Real Madrid or something, you know, they're constantly imbuing the games with professionals as a way, because it's meaningful to them because they watch a ton of soccer, but it's also part of this broader project of making the games fun. That the games the scoring a goal is fun, but when you get the attention from the crowd, when they give you a nickname based on a professional player, it just makes it even more enjoyable. And the pros was a big thing. And again, I mean, I think especially, you know, this is old enough now where, you know, the amount of games you can watch on TV since even 2008. I mean, it's really, they had a lot of interest in the Mexican league, but a really kind of global appetite for soccer, and would bring in all sorts of things. And the few times when I would go watch games with the men at their homes or in a bar or something, they're constantly saying, oh, why can't you do that at the field? So then the pro game was imbued by the pickup game. So it was this kind of back and forth, and all about just making it more fun, more enjoyable, more engrossing. And again, if you showed up that day, you wouldn't necessarily get the joke, you know? So it's also part of being part of this community to get the joke. You know, a lot of, you know, white players would be called, you know, Donovan, you know, or something, every white guy that would show up, and they wouldn't quite get it. But then over time they would understand how that's just another piece of the fun. But I will look at that book. I didn't know that book. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Okay, heel pass to Tony. Okay. With 9 minutes left, pressure's on.
I'll be real quick. So what I like about the book also is that I see this contrast between the time when we played and the time that David is limiting his book to. And somehow with the so-called gentrification of the fields, if you know what I mean, it's like now with the turf, which looks very beautiful, but it comes with restrictions. And many of us have grown up playing soccer in a free atmosphere, pick up soccer, and even many professionals around the world didn't have to pay to play. And one of the things that we talk about among ourselves, soccer players here in the US, is that I think US soccer is not reaching where it should be because of these restrictions. The ability to pay to play, that when I took my kid to the soccer games like 5-year-old, he's paying to play. And I never liked that. And we had to do this traveling where you have to stay in hotels overnight for 6-year-old, for 8-year-old. I mean, this was just too much. And I said, how many people could afford this? So my question is, are we sort of having what is happening to professional soccer in the US in this, our past, where we used to just walk and play? And how does this benefit? Of course, it's good for the immigrants to just go to anywhere and play. But then if you look at overall soccer development in the United States, I think that's what they bring into our parks.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can necessarily speak on the state of U.S. soccer and its relationship to pay-to-play systems, which I agree are really growing. I mean, I will speak maybe more specifically to the Marvista game. And what's interesting is what's going on with the second generation, who was born in L.A., raised in L.A., has a lot of different opportunities, but was also brought by their fathers to the park. So at a very young age, kind of saw what was going on in the park. And they, to my kind of surprise, have, again, it's different. You know, they might have IPAs instead of Modelo, but they've also kind of are carrying on this tradition that, again, I'm not saying it's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, and their wives and girlfriends might be frustrated at times about it. But I do think that, you know, if there's some kind of model to kind of do this, that the younger generation, you know, they can gravitate towards it. And so, again, it's not, I guess I'm just speaking specifically about this park, that that I am actually surprised by how many of the children of these men are continuing to do this, because they see the kind of appeal, and they do it a little differently. But so to answer your point is that the younger generation, they can do this, if they're provided the opportunities to do it in different ways. Now, what that means for the state of soccer, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe there is a relationship to why we're not succeeding as much as we could in terms of how privatized and expensive soccer is. I think a lot of people on this call can speak to that, that might explain why we're not doing as well. Although, you know, we are creating some good players too. So, but yes, there is this growing privatization of play for sure.
Yeah, I was just putting in the chat that this is a recurring theme in many of our FSF discussions. So this feeds into it quite nicely. On pages 68, 69 in chapter 2, you have a wonderful list of nicknames that emerged out of Marvista, which, you know, point to that kind of curiosity, interest, attraction to global soccer. You've got, of course, Maradona, and then the almost omniscient Valderrama, Chilavert, Colocini, Donovan, Totti, for goodness sakes, Benzema, and on and on. So Ted is asking in the chat a question that maybe others have as well. What was your Marvista nickname, sir?
Yeah, so first, I mean, I think I'm glad that the nicknames resonated. And that's another reason why I didn't want to use pseudonyms. This is another thing in, you know, ethnography, is you need to protect your subjects, which I think is overstated. One reason is you lose kind of one of the richest parts of park life, which was the nickname. Some Maradona could be ironic, or it could be tribute. It could be, you're so bad, we're going to call you Maradona. So again, and it's all about being part of that scene to get the joke, because sometimes it wasn't self-evident. And again, we would think it's racist or homophobic, but it's about something else that's kind of going on. So there is, and I'm glad that kind of has resonated. And what's interesting, and then this goes back to, I think, Titi's earlier, I think she's gone, comment about kind of my positionality, if you will, as this, yes, serious player, very committed player, but also the kind of sociologist. And when I initially came, yeah, I got bombarded mainly with gringo or guero, or my dad's from France, so I'll get Frenchy. And, you know, I had all these kind of, you know, random kind of nicknames, but I was often just referred to as David. And if they said on the phone, el guero or the gringo. But I also think that maybe reflected, maybe it's just my personality. I don't look like somebody, I don't know. But it's interesting that I was always careful to remind them that I was doing research as well. And because I would, you know, which I thought was important, and maybe that's reflected, I don't know. But I, to answer Ted's question, no nickname really stuck. Interestingly, my son, who was born while I was there, Zizou, you know, that was his name. So he didn't even, couldn't speak, couldn't walk. And he gets a nickname right away. Because maybe they felt more comfortable doing that with him than they did with me, which goes back to Titi's, you know, we all have different experiences with the field, and I don't know, maybe I'm a downer. So I'm sure there's some psychological explanation of why I never got a nickname.
All right, Zizou, huh? So watch out. If you get into a heated discussion, you might run into problems.
Yeah.
Or maybe you'll just put the ball through your legs. Any final comments for David or questions?
I was thinking a little bit about how I mean, so much of the book does seem about like in-group, out-group. I mean, I'm thinking a little bit like a psychologist, right? There's the sort of in-group, out-group, like within the game, in the community, in the neighborhood. And then, and that relates to this process of othering, right? And like, who is the other and who is the insider? And it strikes, I mean, I'm wondering this trajectory of American soccer becoming more comfortable with the idea that soccer is not just the other, right? That it is also us. Like, does that, it made me wonder, like, are these games, I do think 20 or 30 years ago, these games, you know, people like me, you know, would have driven by and said, that's the other, like that's, but I wonder if that's changing a little bit. Like I just sort of to finish on a more optimistic note, like could the changing nature of American soccer change that othering that seems prominent in the book?
Absolutely. And I think this othering, it's a vice versa thing as well. So a lot of outsiders would say that's kind of a strange space. I don't feel comfortable there. I think the South African was saying he was, you know, the one kind of non-Guatemalan on the team. But that is really changing. And I also think the Latinos are like, wow, some white guys can really play. and they also appreciate the culture and the game. And the friend from Atlanta, Declan, you know, I'm sure, you know, the younger generation, they're skillful and they're into this in a way that, you know, that my generation, it still was kind of uncomfortable for both groups. There was an othering of the both. And where now in Mar Vista, if a white guy shows up and is good and wants to play and wants to have a beer after, that's becoming more and more kind of normal to them. And to end on an optimistic point, as Andrew suggested, this is a nice thing, and both for community, but also the growth of soccer. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of young guys over in Europe, and I don't know, maybe they had a taste of this growing up in some way. I don't know. Probably not. Probably a lot of travel soccer. But yeah, it's othering is breaking down, I think, from both directions, which is fun to see.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note to end on, an uplifting note. You know, this book has been really a pleasure to read at a time when playing pickup soccer is extremely difficult, and when many of us miss precisely the kind of sociability that you described so well. You know, I know, speaking for myself, that's been most definitely one of the most challenging things about the last 15 months or so. Missing that very natural, basic human interaction that we love on the pitch, and those easy conversations, those jokes, maybe occasionally even the sort of aggressive confrontations. I'm not even sure I know how it's going to feel when I get back on the pitch, hopefully in a couple of weeks. But you really brought it back to life, kind of grim days, I think it was extraordinarily valuable, as well as your intellectual contributions. And I want to thank everyone who was on this call. It's great to see you all. I also want to let you know that there is another session planned for around the time of the Euros starting. And I'll send information out soon by email. It's the book by Chris Boltzmann and Dill Porter on Corinthians, the gentlemen amateurs. So look for that information. And there's some discounted prices available for the book, so that should make it more affordable for everyone. So without further ado, thanks again, David. Thank you, everyone. I'll leave you with the FSF anthem again. Take care, everyone. Stay safe.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure. Thank you. All right.